Welcome to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud, available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, or Apple Podcasts. Head on over to the website, AmericaOutLoud.com, and check out the articles and podcasts, and please feel free to share those on social media. We have a big show tonight with the co-founder of the Tea Party, Michael Johns. But first off, let me see how, Rob, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Minus the allergies that are acting up on me because it's springtime. So our listeners might notice that my voice will go deeper, deeper, and deeper as the night progresses. I gotta say, I kind of like it. I like when my voice is deep like that. It gives me this like command. I'm like, I'm in charge of things, but just want them to know, just in case they go, what's happening with his voice? Well, that's what's happening. It's allergy seasons. Yeah. And I'm affected by it.
Allergy season is no joke here in Illinois this year.
Tell me about it.
These grass allergies are killing me.
You know what? I don't think I suffered from the allergies last year, 2020, because we're all locked inside because of the China virus that they were scaring everyone with. No, I wasn't. I don't think it bothered me at all. But anyway, I'm excited to have Michael Johns back again on the show tonight. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the genesis of 9/11, although we know what happened. Some of you do, some of you don't. But he's going to talk to us about that. He had kind of like an up-close view of things that were moving around and his thoughts leaving Iraq. He might cover a little bit about Afghanistan, one of the longest wars that we've ever been at. So I can't wait to hear what he has to say to us. So without further ado, let's just bring him on so that he could have as much time as he needs to talk about this in our first segment. Michael, how's it going, sir?
Good to be with you guys. How you been?
We're good. I don't know about you. Like I said, are you suffering from allergies? Do you suffer from allergies?
It is definitely an allergy season. And I realized when I was sneezing indoors that it's a particularly bad one.
So you guys might hear us sneezing here or there, but we're fine. We don't have the virus or anything. It's just the allergies has us. So, Michael, we opened up talking about 9/11. And that's been like, oh, wow, like 19, almost 20 years ago that the country was attacked.
Yeah, it's really incredible. It doesn't seem that long ago to me.
No.
But, you know, certainly for younger people, it's sort of ancient history, if it's even a memory at all. And I was impressed by the fact that we had individuals who were deployed to Afghanistan who had not even been born when 9/11 occurred.
So, that is so true.
Yeah. As you correctly say, longest war in American history and longest war for a lot of reasons. I mean, partly because of the complexity of Afghanistan, which has been under foreign occupation for almost all of its modern history. I mean, you know, prior to the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan, of course, it was under Soviet occupation, stemming from their invasion in 1979. And then prior to that, you know, British occupation. None of those were easy or without a lot of difficulty. Afghanistan has been a very resilient nation. A highly undeveloped one. And as we learned prior to 9/11, also one that has been hospitable towards some very dangerous forces. And we've reached the point, I think we may have reached it years ago, but we certainly reached it now, where I think the incremental or additional role of a U.S. presence there is probably more complicating and endangering than it is beneficial. And ultimately, the future of Afghanistan is going to have to be largely in the hands of Afghans, as it should be. But we've successfully, you know, and largely removed Al-Qaeda, the primary terrorist force behind 9/11, and I think created hopefully a new beginning for that troubled nation.
Yeah, we did remove Al-Qaeda thanks to President Trump. I think that you had a lot of these terrorist groups forming once Barack Obama came into office, but Trump showed them no mercy. Now, we must give credit to Trump for, you know, getting rid of, not Trump, but Obama for getting rid of bin Laden. But other than that, I mean, we saw the uprise of so many other terrorist groups and, you know,
yeah, well, it's intriguing with bin Laden because, you know, bin Laden's engagement in terrorism was well known long before 9/11. And there actually were opportunities during his presence in the Sudan for Clinton to have potentially removed him from the battlefield. And Clinton did not act on that. Of course, we paid the price ultimately for that. Would have required some forethought and foresight. And it's always 2020 rearview mirror look as far as what might have been. But when you consider nearly 3,000 American deaths, certainly one that's difficult not to dwell a bit on as far as what if we had acted more decisively. And it was a consideration during the Clinton administration when his exact location within Sudan had been identified.
Why did you think Clinton didn't move forward to take him out? Why was there such a hesitancy to get rid of these bad players? I mean, I know that we're not in the business of, you know, killing, you know, other leaders of foreign countries, but he's not even a leader, but just bad players as a whole. There was like a missed opportunity.
Yeah, the consideration there was always one, would it serve to minimize terrorist activity out of Al-Qaeda, or would it actually inspire Al-Qaeda to be even more aggressive? And two, risks of civilian deaths or casualties. You know, this was probably in the early period of some of these more remote military technologies that have become much more refined in the years that have gone by. And so some conscious recognition really that, you know, that there was risk involved in that. But it's been a subject for those who've really dived into understanding the evolution of Al-Qaeda and how they came to be viewed as and came to develop as a formidable terrorist force, a legitimate question as far as whether or not it was the right decision. And of course, that story even goes back further to one that I was also involved in, and that was the provision of military aid to the Mujahideen during the Soviet occupation. It's often wrongly depicted that the United States had played a role in aiding Al-Qaeda's development, but I can tell you, you know, as someone who's very engaged in the Reagan Doctrine during that time, you know, there were sort of two components of the Mujahideen. One was the Afghan Mujahideen, which was largely pro-American, was very clear on the fact that it was, you know, there to object to the Soviet occupation. And then there was the sort of the Arab Mujahideen, of which Bin Laden was a member, and Bin Laden had, you know, gone into Afghanistan from Saudi Arabia to resist it, but really viewed the conflict as more of a global one, not one narrowly focused on the Soviets. It's a complicated history, and it does point, you know, in fairness to the conclusion that a lot of us have reached, that overreach can also be a problem. But there's no second guessing, I don't think, the decision of the United States to aid the Mujahideen during the Soviet occupation. I mean, that proved to be a very defining moment. And, you know, without that aid, literally the end of the Cold War, I think, may not have manifested the way it did. It was a very defining moment of our ability to raised the cost of that Soviet occupation of Afghanistan.
Right. And then you look ahead, and the support for the Afghanistan war initially was very high after the attacks on 9/11. And then we moved on to Iraq, and then this whole weapons of mass destruction situation. And a lot of people insinuated back then that the fall of Iraq could lead to the rise of Iran. If we're looking back in hindsight right now, do you think it was a good decision for us to enter into Iraq when we did?
No, not in retrospect. At the time, in fairness, which I think was true of most on our side, I kind of had a more, I was a, you know, I took for granted that we were being given accurate intelligence information about Saddam's capabilities from standpoint of weapons of mass destruction. Of course, he did possess weapons of mass destruction, if you include chemical weapons within that, which he had deployed in the Iran-Iraq war. So we can, you can bicker over the definition of that. But at the time when they referred to weapons of mass destruction, of course, they were referring to nuclear weapons. And in retrospect, the Bush 43 administration, you know, there were two fundamental errors really that were made on their watch. One was the poor intelligence that they acted on ultimately in convincing the Congress to authorize the use of force against Saddam. But I think also you have to go back and look at 9/11 itself and say, you know, this was an attack on U.S. territory, the largest in our history, the most deadly in our history. And it did happen on that administration's watch. And there was forewarning. There was no conspiracy around 9/11. I was a senior aide, as you may know, to Governor Kaine, who chaired the 9/11 commission, who investigated that. You know, they conducted well over 1,000 interviews, 10 countries around the world. And really developed, I think, a definitive report that concluded a number of very broad things. It concluded that some of these things have not really been acted on sufficiently, one of which was that our intel agencies have not been sufficiently integrated or communicating the way they should be. Out of that really grew the Department of Homeland Security, also the Director of National Intelligence. It's designed to coordinate intel activities, and that's had some, I think, modest improvement in the functionality, but clearly there's still a lot of improvement to be done there. And then, you know, the second issue were these overstayed visas, and it was an immigration component to 9/11, meaning, among the 19 perpetuators of 9/11. A good number of them should not have been in the United States at that time and were here because they had overstayed visas. And pretty much last I checked, we're still not sufficiently policing or enforcing these visa stays. We have individuals who routinely come here on these limited 180-day visas and stay indefinitely, and you'd find many citizens of this country who arrived here that way.
In hindsight, Michael, do you think that we could have avoided 9/11? Do you think that there was enough intel that we could have stopped the attackers?
I really do. And I'm going to tell you, there's a great movie out for those who aren't kind of inclined to look at history that way, called Charlie Wilson's War, that looks at the war of the Mujahideen against the Soviets during the Soviet occupation, but it dives a little bit in at the end to the neglect of Afghanistan after the Soviets departed. So as the Soviets departed, and this was the story really with the removal of Saddam in Iraq as well, if you create these power vacuums in the Middle East and they quickly get filled, and quite often not by the best individuals. I think there was a moment of time after the Soviet departure in Afghanistan where some degree of attentiveness to Afghanistan would have been immensely beneficial in precluding Al-Qaeda and even the Taliban's rise to prominence in that country, which of course is what allowed this terrorist movement to organize and train for not just this attack, but many terrorist attacks globally. And we were forewarned. I mean, we had our allies in that battle who gave us information regarding it. That information was probably not sufficiently taken seriously enough. But there was no inside job regarding 9/11. There was no conspiracy related to 9/11. And, I think one of the great unfortunate developments looking at this thing now through history is that you still have so many Americans who view that as like a credible thesis, and it's a baseless one.
Why is that? Why do so many people think that it was an inside job. I've looked at the facts. I've looked at the evidence. And even without that, I've never thought that it was an inside job. I do believe that we could have done more to stop it.
Yeah.
I think that we knew a lot. But to say that it was an inside job, I'm so far removed from that, and I could never believe it. But there is a certain population that's out there, and they seem to lean, unfortunately, right on the right, that think that, or so they say, that it was an inside job.
Well, yeah.
I was just going to say, I'm sure the conspiracy theorists are screaming at their screens right now that, what about Tower 7, the building that would have been the tallest building in, I believe, over 40 states that fell on its own without ever being hit by an airplane? That's one of the unanswered questions, but I agree with Michael that obviously was not an inside job, but I think that was just one of those things that gave some smoke to the conspiracy fire.
Well, look, there was a lot of scrutiny of Tower 7, and ultimately, we haven't had airplanes hitting high-rise buildings, and so the collateral damage associated with that is not one that you can make a lot of comparisons to. If you were sitting, as I'm sure I was, and you guys were, I was actually in New York when this happened, and you watched it. There was a period of time that went by between the collapse of the two buildings, which, you know, made it unusual, but there was nothing usual about it. And that issue was very definitively resolved in multiple studies, including in the 9/11 report, as to its, you know, actual collapse and how the debris that hit it actually started fires within the within Building 7, and that in turn contributed to the structural damage that ultimately led to its the building's collapse. There was no conspiracy, nor if there had been a conspiracy, was there a need for Building 7 to fall. I mean, you already had hit to the first tower, and none of it really adds up to much. I mean, to answer your question as to why a considerable number of people might feel this way, I find that whenever you have a development or a series of developments that are unusual, hugely unusual, even in this case unprecedented, they give rise to thinking along those lines. And it's the nature of those, I think, you seek to find alternative explanations to issues that for which the actual given explanation itself is sometimes baffling enough.
Right. You know? So given all that we know and what happened, why do you think Bush decided to go after Saddam Hussein and not go into Afghanistan first? What was a concerted effort to focus everything on Saddam?
Well, remember, we really did go into Afghanistan first. I mean, that was the first military action that we took in 01 from the standpoint of targeting Al-Qaeda. And then it was 03 by the time we had actually gone in against Saddam. So there was a period of several years there. You can recall there was a period of negotiation with Saddam's government in which we tried to resolve inspections, and they were reluctant and resistant. And quite honestly, Saddam's government was in a lot of ways its own worst enemy, in the sense that I think they were trying to project regionally that they did possess nuclear capacity. That was part of their projection of strength within the region. And so their, lack of cooperation on inspections was immensely unhelpful as it relates to deterring our military aggression. And then, of course, we had the congressional authorization after really we'd exhausted all diplomatic possibilities of engaging with them on it.
Michael, did the death of Saddam and the fall of Iraq make Iran stronger, like so many fear would happen before the war started?
Yeah, I mean, you might look at it. This is maybe an oversimplification, but you might look at it the way today we look at Iran and Saudi Arabia, where you have these two primary forces that are largely at odds. But there's no denying that the Saudis have been a kind of constraining force on Iran's aggression. Iran and Iraq had enormous tension. They underwent, you know, an actual very bloody war between the two countries. It was an incredibly brutal conflict in which chemical weapons were utilized. And Saddam was an autocrat, a bad guy within the region, but but in most ways, Iran was the greater hostile power toward the United States. That's still, of course, being the case, where opposition to U.S. interests around the world and development of nuclear weapons, largest state sponsor of terror, are immensely threatening.
Joe Biden is talking about pulling all the troops out of Iraq right now. And of course, the media acts like it's great. But when President Trump recommended it, they acted like it would cause all these issues. But here we are. Joe Biden has mentioned withdrawing troops from Iraq. Do you think the time is now to do it? And do you think there will be any problematic results if Joe Biden does go ahead with withdrawing all the American troops from Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, we've reached the point where I think, ISIS is obviously eliminated fully, and a lot of credit there goes to President Trump and his very decisive military victory over ISIS, which was a campaign promise that he made. And you might recall, I mean, ISIS had possession of large portions of Iraq, large portions of Syria, and that has now no longer the case. But like Afghanistan, Iraq is a complicated country with a lot of extraordinary diversity in ethnic groups and in political outlooks, and it's a difficult country to stabilize. I mean, that, if Saddam did anything constructive, I think and this was a recognition many have had since his demise, is the fact that it's pretty miraculous that he held the country together in his own way. And he did it in a brutal way, so I'm not justifying the means in which he did it. He did it in an autocratic way. But you have so many forces within Iraq that are either separatist in nature or aggressive in nature, that's not an easy accomplishment.
You think that Bush was ill-advised when he went into both Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yeah, I do. I feel it's been one of a series of serious misguided intelligence conclusions. I think the implicit in your question is whether there was any political manipulation of intelligence for the purposes of that. We obviously witnessed that in the allegations regarding Russian collusion, so it's not inconceivable. This war was immensely costly. By costly, that means there were beneficiaries of it. This was intelligence that was presented to a broad range of people, not just to President Bush, but remember, to both parties in Congress, and was sufficiently convincing to a lot of individuals, including Joe Biden, who voted, wasn't just voting for it, he was a champion of it. Hillary Clinton, who was a champion of it. And so that intel was convincing to an extraordinary number of people who have to live with the votes that they had made at the time. And I gave you my perspective on it historically. I think the action, by and large, with the passage of time, with the loss of American lives, with the cost of that conflict, and with the rise of ISIS and the strengthening of Iran regionally, you can't help but look at it and conclude that it wasn't a very significant strategic and intelligence error.
What did we gain? The loss of life. Our kids, our sons and daughters out there, and for what? For information that was inaccurate. I mean, I would think that someone, that people would say, someone has to pay.
You go back, and of course, you have these two conflicts. I mean, I was in Kuwait after the liberation of Kuwait twice. In fact, I was there. One of these was so clear cut in the sense that you had the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait still was fresh in the minds of many. And the had that occupation been allowed to stand, particularly the impact it would have had strategically and on regional resources, including petroleum, would have been universally negative. But then, you know, our military accomplishment there was expeditious, you know, really a series of days. And the invasion of, and there were those at the time who criticized the president I worked for, George H.W. Bush, saying, why didn't you go to Baghdad? Why didn't you take out Saddam? And the answer was that wasn't part of the strategic mission. And the mission was to simply to liberate the illegal occupation of Kuwait during that time. And that was done quickly, successfully, and with minimal loss of life. And it was, even at its time, an immensely stressful mission with a lot of uncertainties.
In retrospect, do you think President Trump could have done more to get our troops out of the Middle East? Obviously, he did some great things by killing Gaddafi and Soleimani, but he promised to, he would remove all the troops, and he did not get that accomplished in his first 4 years. I imagine he planned on it in his next 4 years. But do you think he could have or should have done more in his time in office?
Well, I think you saw, you know, that there was a linear progression of reduction of our troop presence under his watch. And so he was executing on that plan. Now, again, there was pushback within institutions, and you can come back to this theme we've talked about before of personnel, in the sense that the biggest opponents that he had to the more expeditious withdrawal that might have occurred were from some of his own appointees who didn't want to see it happen, and you know, within the Pentagon and within the intel community. And there were differing viewpoints internally, and he yielded to some of that guidance. But by and large, I mean, Trump's legacy in Iraq is one of troop reduction and diminished, not increased presence there. And obviously, as I mentioned, the elimination of ISIS, which allowed for the stabilization largely of our strategic goals.
Yeah, we are here with co-founder of the Tea Party and White House speechwriter Michael Johns, and you are tuned into After Dark with Rob and Andrew, available on America Out Loud via iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the America Out Loud app to keep track of all of the great shows. We will be back with more from our guest Michael Johns to talk about 9/11 and if Mayor Rudy Giuliani is being treated unfairly by the Biden administration.
Is a record player the best way to listen to music? Of course not. So why are you still taking vitamins that haven't been upgraded since the 1930s? Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, it's time to upgrade to Healthy Cells pill-free, patent-pending microgel supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. They taste great, convenient on the go, and they're more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
AmericaOutloud.com is the alternative from the agenda-driven globalist. Here, we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. On-demand podcast or real-time talk radio with our streaming apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio, liberty and justice for all.
And we are back after dark with Rob and Andrew, and our guest is Michael Johns. Our first segment, Michael was talking to us about the genesis of 9/11, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, one of the longest wars that the United States has ever fought in. Should we have even gone into either of the countries? Was it worth it? Look at the lives that were lost because of it. If you're around now, you probably, say you're 21 years old or 20 years old when this first took place, 9/11. And what do we have to show? Did we make the country safer? Is the country any better in that geographical location of the world?
The answer there, Rob, is you got to separate Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, yes, Iraq, there were, you know, extraordinary questions about justification, ultimately, in retrospect, for our engagement. But the Afghan conflict and making it clear that there would be ramifications for this terrorist attack and the extraordinary damage that we've done to Al-Qaeda's strategic capabilities, it makes, in my judgment, that a very clear-cut decision as far as our involvement. And yes, the country is stronger off and better off because we have been able to eliminate Al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan. Iraq was a much more complicated scenario. I'm not so sure, given the damage that ISIS did and being able to arise in that power vacuum. I think that's a much more questionable undertaking ultimately. But yeah, you know, we had almost 4,000 deaths in Iraq, about 2,000, as I recall, in Afghanistan. And those are, you know, the biggest conflicts since Vietnam.
The death of bin Laden has always baffled me as to when we had an opportunity to take him out, and we didn't. And then the close relationship that the Bushes had, bin Laden's family. Do you think that was one of the reasons why Bush didn't take him out?
No, I don't think it was a consideration at all. In fact, most of his family had denounced him and disavowed him. So while it is true that, you know, he had a large family, in fact, there was a bin Laden at my university, ultimately, they were not in any way apologetic or supportive of what he had ultimately become. He became very radicalized through a series of exposures and experiences that he had, including the role that he played in Afghanistan originally against the Soviet occupation, but even predating that.
Right. And, you know, when you do look at this, one person that we can't forget is Mayor Giuliani and how he commandeered New York City.
Did a great job.
He did a fantastic job and was known as America's mayor. And you look at how he's being treated now with the FBI raid. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
This is now the second time this has occurred with the raiding of a attorney for Donald Trump. It is hugely unusual to see warrants of this nature issued against individuals who serve as counsel to anyone, much less as counsel to a prominent individual like the President of the United States. And it seems to me to have been excessive and unwarranted, just a series of mistreatments of individuals in the Trump orbit. Nor do I believe that there is any wrongdoing on behalf of Rudy Giuliani. And the issues that we're talking about here are not, even the presumed allegations apparently were presented by prosecutors for securing the warrant aren't ones that would have required that magnitude of aggression. It really seems to me to be part of an ongoing criminalization of American politics, which is what we've witnessed. And I think it is one of the great deficiencies of the last 4 years that this Justice Department was both acknowledged as being highly political and still to this day has not been sufficiently corrected as it relates either to processes or to personnel. And, you know, there's really no role for individuals who are going at the highest levels of American justice who are going to be utilizing those positional authority to exert any political agenda. And we've seen example after example after example of exactly that.
If only we had an honest media to call this situation out. This obviously on paper, you look at what Rudy Giuliani's been doing the past couple of years, going after Hunter Biden and his Ukraine and China dealings. And now you have Rudy Giuliani just a few months into the Joe Biden administration getting his apartment raided. How does the Biden administration come across and have this look like anything other than political revenge?
Well, it looks like political revenge. I mean, I think that's the perception that it has. The only thing they've been able to do is to sort of keep the president separated from it, at least as it relates to their representation of the facts that he wasn't involved in the authorization of it, which, you know, is probably true, given the benefit of the doubt on that. But you still have, you know, essentially execution of prosecution against a broad number of individuals within the Trump orbit and no action. We're 2 years since Durham now has been put into place on the Russiagate investigation, just nothing coming out of that. That was the first thing that crossed my mind when I heard about the Giuliani raid. You know, what's going on with this? Still not, as you can recall, it was like last summer, we were told that it would have a report and likely, you know, prosecutions by Labor Day. Then they kind of blamed the pandemic on, you know, not being able to execute on that deadline. And but surely it would happen by Election Day. We got to Election Day and people went out to vote without really any definitive reporting or accountability from this Justice Department, either on the crimes of Russiagate, which still linger unprosecuted largely, and on the crimes of Hunter Biden and what Hunter Biden's been up to. I mean, as recently as tonight, I mean, I was just on OWN this evening and talking a bit about the fact that his 10% ownership stake in this CCP, Chinese Communist Party, owned investment fund is still not been divested, according to the last reports on it. We still don't know precisely the $3.5 million that he received by wire from the wife of former mayor of Moscow, one of Putin's closest aides, what that was even for. And to your point on the media, those are logical questions. That would be like the logical question you would ask is, what was the $3.5 million for? What, you know, and why? And it now was asked about why he hasn't divested on the China fund, and of course that was just deflected and referred out elsewhere. But Biden himself had promised his family would be out of these foreign entanglements, and according to last reporting, that's not the case as it relates to Hunter Biden.
You know, just looking at all this, why? So it seems that the FBI, the CIA, and the Justice Department have all become so weaponized. I go back to Bill Barr. I was impressed with Bill Barr when he came on. He talked a good talk, walked the walk right up into the election. He was saying the things, not only that we wanted to hear, but things that were truthful about mail-in ballots, about how the FBI had completely gone off the rails and the Justice Department, and how he was there to bring back the sanctity of those institutions. But when it really mattered, when it came to the point that he could have made a difference, he faded away.
Look at the election fraud. I mean, we almost just look at the debate around it and the fact that we just kind of skip over the logical fact that the institution that you would most rely on to investigate, prosecute criminal wrongdoing or ethical wrongdoing on election processes would be the Department of Justice, that has numerous departments dedicated exclusively to that. And when you look at the debate that went around it, we almost just skipped over that. Like, well, of course they're not going to do that. that is an extraordinary recognition. It's a very damning recognition as it relates to the status of that. And yet to this day, thousands of affidavits signed under penalty of criminal law, and these individuals haven't even been contacted by the Department of Justice. This is a very sensitive moment in the way that if you were a foreign enemy of this country, let's say you were China, you're starting to see a very significant erosion of confidence in some of our core institutions. I think that's clearly the case as it relates to how the country views Biden himself. I'm astonished on this vaccination progress. As of this weekend, we're at still not even 40% of individuals who've gotten the vaccine. And let's just set aside what your view is on the on vaccinations, because it's, I think we all would agree, the three of us would agree that those almost have to be individual decisions, not government mandates. But for this administration, it was priority one, really, was to communicate how essential this herd immunity was. And yet this guy has brought such limited energy and limited persuasiveness to his messaging on this issue, that combined with what is, you know, some understandable skepticism by the American people, has us not even halfway to this herd immunity. And you have to say that those who were inclined to get vaccinated probably acted on that pretty immediately, right? I mean, this is now 4 months or so that we've had these vaccines available.
Right.
You know, you're not, I would imagine that the number of individuals who are just now sort of saying, well, yeah, I had to go get this. I think you're now into a grouping of individuals who may be still inclined to do it or maybe thinking about it, but they have trepidation. And I think the position is you got to look at, you know, sort of FDR and the Depression and Kennedy and space exploration and Reagan and the Cold War, and say Biden's mission, as at least as advertised in his campaign, was he was going to sort of get this done. And he has, and we might, you know, disagree that that was the top agenda that's confronting the administration, but it was his top agenda, and he has failed miserably. And he's failed miserably in part because, in large part, in my view, because he does not have the credibility of leadership that you typically associate with a president, combined with the fact that his ability to lead, his speaking, his persuasiveness, his actions, what appears to continue to be this sort of low energy presidency, just is not inspiring any Americans to view this as any collective or, as he worded it, patriotic undertaking.
Right, because all of his accolades are coming from the media. Like, there's no energy, there's no enthusiasm, but yet still they are couching this as if though he has done a tremendously fantastic job, when we see and we know with our own eyes that he hasn't done either. And what's even scarier is the push to take away civil liberties, so it seems, if you don't get the vaccine. I don't think that there's anything wrong with the vaccine, but to come out and then start to, these undertones of you can't come into society or you can't do this. I heard the other day, we have a lot of the commentators and pundits that are saying, we should shun all those people that don't want the vaccine. And I guarantee you, if you were to look closely at the numbers, if you look at the numbers and you see who actually the people that don't want to take it. They're saying that they are Trump conservatives. Yes, I'm sure that there are some, but I would bet you anything, a lot of them are on the left because I've spoken to them.
Yeah, they want to. There was a big spread in the New York Times over the weekend on this where they were trying to make exactly that argument, Rob, that these were evangelical Christians associated with the, you know, the Trump right, who were sort of not getting this as sort of an act of political rebellion against Biden. And you're right, they're wrong. This is more of a mixed bag of a broad range of individuals across, you know, not individuals, it's, you know, at 40%, it's a lion's share of the country. It just is not responding to the messaging of this president. And that's the point that I'm making, which is conjecture, admittedly. But I believe had Trump been in his second term right now, his messaging on this would be more persuasive, because we're in the absence of this herd immunity, in the absence of that level of protection, this thing just kind of lingers. And now it's mutating, right? With questions about whether or not the mutations themselves are covered by the vaccines or not. That's only going to further, I think, raise questions about among individuals about whether the vaccine is or is not a good idea. And it's only going to allow some states and locales to, you know, consider to second guess the reopening, though you have some states like Florida today taking a really, you know, bold initiative in reopening. And, you know, one thing you certainly would not be doing at this point is having the border open with when one of those major mutations is coming out of Brazil and you're looking at individuals who were possibly exposed to it. But this broader issue, which is kind of where I started this, is that this president, probably unlike any in our lifetimes, is just, he's not resonating with the American people, okay? And, you know, I say that knowing that the three of us didn't vote for him and didn't support him, but ultimately, you know, at least it was the case of prior Democrats who we probably also didn't vote for, I know I didn't, that they had the positional authority and credibility of this presidency. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like when you question whether he's there legitimately, as so many Americans do, as uncomfortable as that might be to media elite, et cetera, they're logically going to question what they hear out of, you know, as far as what the American people should be doing. I am of the opinion that there are two issues that we confront right now as a country that we really can't move forward as a country until they're resolved. One was November 3. We'll see what comes out of it, Arizona, but we can't turn the page until that's resolved. We need resolution on this. We need closure on it. And we need people that are going to champion it like the grassroots are on a national level. And then the second is the origins of this pandemic, which certainly seem to be increasingly pointing to coming out of the P4 lab in Wuhan, and the fact that that this was released either consciously or perhaps by error, but that was the origin of it, and that China has spent now well over a year trying to mislead the world about the origin of this and about what has been their complicity and in misleading key institutions like the World Health Organization and others in ways that have been detrimental to containing it, meaning the death rates and the cost. And we're looking at, you know, an estimated $16 trillion cost to this economy. That's almost a full year of GDP for this country. That, you know, that's the second issue. We need resolution on that. And the resolution has got to be also their acknowledgement and accountability for this wrongdoing. I mean, this too can't just simply be allowed to linger. And now we have the DNI for Trump administration saying that, you know, China's Communist Party did in fact meddle in the 20 election. Now that meddling has to be maybe better defined than it has been. But I go through and I look at the fact that we have China now on the hook for the pandemic, China designated as being engaged in genocidal behavior with the treatment of the Uyghurs. So you could probably apply that to what they've done with the Tibetans and others, and their, you know, theft of hundreds of billions of dollars in intellectual property. And we have a State Department in the Biden administration is talking about rules-based order and things like that. This is not a government that has played by the rules. So we can't be functioning our relationship based on that. They've achieved the second largest economy in the world, largely by breaking the rules.
Yeah, it's so frustrating to see China. It looks like more and more every single day, especially with this Joe Biden administration, that they're going to get away with releasing this virus out of the Wuhan lab without any accountability whatsoever. It doesn't sound like they're going to have to face any consequences, at least from us here in the United States. The first thing Joe Biden did was rejoin the Chinese-bought World Health Organization, if that shows you where his priorities are at. Michael, do you think any of the, and now you look at what's going on in India, and it's an absolute humanitarian disaster. Do you think any of these countries, Michael, are going to try and press China and make them pay any consequences for releasing this virus onto the world?
Well, I think it's got to be a collective undertaking, and I think we have to be a part of it. I think we have to be a lead on it. And I don't think there's any denying that they hold the responsibility. So even under the best case set of scenarios, there's no doubt that they misled the World Health Organization. There's no doubt that they destroyed the samples of the virus. No doubt that they denied entry to CDC and World Health Organization inspectors. No doubt that they disappeared the whistleblowers. No doubt that they swept up a bunch of PPE that they subsequently sold at a profit. The list of indisputable facts of wrongdoing as it relates to Xi Jinping's government is pretty indisputable. And then you add in the fact that, well, this whole gain of function research itself was questionable and dangerous, and we identified it as dangerous. And that's the other component of this is, you know, so we had NIH money under Tony Fauci that was being sent in there to support this research. Where are the, to your point of media bias or media, a lack of critical media questioning, this guy, what has he done now? 500 interviews? And to my knowledge, no one has said pointedly, Dr. Fauci, what were you doing putting millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars into the Wuhan Institute of Virology? Because he's contradicting himself on just about everything else. You can go back and look at what he said about masks in the 60 Minutes interview in March of 2020, where he questioned the effectiveness of it. You can go back and look at what Fauci had to say about Americans had nothing to really worry about as it related to the pandemic. In his judgment, that obviously proved to be completely untrue. You can go back and look at how wrong he was on the travel ban that President Trump, to his great credit, put in place on January 30. You go back and look at how wrong he was, in my view, point on therapeutics and the fact that there was indisputable value in those. And you can even look at the at his prediction that there was no way we would get these vaccines rolled out in a year, that it would take longer. Wrong on that as well. I think I've made the point that I'm open to being corrected on if I'm wrong on that. I feel that Fauci has been wrong on every major public prediction he's made as it relates to this, and why this guy is held in such universally high esteem is baffling to me when there's other in the Trump administration, like Peter Navarro, for instance, who were right on just about every major decision they made, is, you know, perplexing to me. The only pushback I'd say on the media is that they do feel like, hey, we kind of made you. And they start to, you know, ultimately come around to holding them to some degree of accountability. And I've noticed in a few of these Fauci interviews more recently that even, you know, even his MSNBC type interviews where he's being viewed with kind of a roll of the eyes, you know, I mean, you can just, there's too much spin involved in his responses. He's too nuanced. And that's not what we're looking for. I mean, the American people are looking for definitive science-based guidance on what's going on with this thing. What should they be doing? And legitimate questions that are still really not answered in a concrete way. And what is the roadmap out of this? And how long is it going to take? And he certainly has not been a source of definitive answers on any of those major questions.
Well, I will agree with you. He has been wrong on all of it, the same way Joe Biden has been wrong on all of our foreign policy situations. But one thing that I want to get at is when you look at all this and what has happened with the virus and the vaccine, and by definitely being a failure and getting people to take it because of all the mixed messaging, and in a clandestine way, they want Trump to come out and say, take the vaccine. Now, he has said it, but they want him to make an advertisement, a promotional. And I say to President Trump, don't do it. If Biden can't give him the credit for Operation Warp Speed, he couldn't even mention that during his state of the I'm going to give everything away address. All he had to do was say, and I want to thank my predecessor, because we would not have Operation Warp Speed if it weren't for him. But his advisors around him told him, don't do it. And to me, a person who said that he wanted to bring everyone together, he talks about unity. Well, it starts at the top, and he's yet to demonstrate that unity. Instead, he's practicing the politics of being divisive and not unity.
Yeah, right back to the inauguration speech. What was the main thesis of that entire presentation? It was about how it was time to unify the country, as if somehow we weren't unified. I mean, we were unified. We weren't unified the way he wanted to see us unified. We weren't unified around his agenda or his vision, but we were unified as significantly as we are now. I think today what you've got are kind of two constituencies. You've got those who question the legitimacy of his presidency and certainly the direction that he's taken us on a policy level. And then you've got, tens of millions of others who say, I don't know, he's better than Trump for some reason, which I'm not even sure if I understand the basis for that thinking. Certainly it's not in any major accomplishment, because 100 days into this thing, you got to say this guy is failing on pretty much all fronts. The only thing I will give them credit on is that, they have not removed the genocidal definition on China's Communist Party, on the Uyghurs. Kudos to, we got to give them credit for that. All right. And I did feel sort of watching Biden's Secretary of State in the 60 Minutes interview blankly over the weekend that maybe all this pressure that we've placed on them as it relates to their conflicts of interest and their historical dealings with the CCP has led them to at least recognize the seriousness of what we face. And, I feel like for all of my frustrations about the election, for all my frustrations about their policy vision, I am rooting for them. I do want to see our country be successful. And, between the Biden State Department and China's Communist Party, I'm going to root for Biden's State Department every day of the week because the alternative is too frightening to imagine.
Yeah, that's a good point. When a Democrat is a president, Republicans want to see them do well because that means America does well. And wow, guys, that was a fantastic conversation tonight. Thank you so much to co-founder of the Tea Party, Michael Johns, for joining us. And thank you for joining us tonight on After Dark with Rob and Andrew. Check us out and all of the other shows over at AmericaOutloud.com, who just celebrated its 5th anniversary. You can also find America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, or Stitcher. We will see you next time. And remember, stand for something or you will fall for nothing.